Blog Talk Radio.
Alternative career and lifestyle.
Radio Enzo.
New media. Self-realization. Metaphysics. Quantum.
Conscious living. The modern world.
Frontier science. Travel. Spirituality.
Welcome to Radio Enzo.
Welcome to Radio Enzo. We are broadcasting live from Enzo Studios in sunny San Diego, California. I'm your host, Greg Berg. It's Radio Enzo, Tools and Inspiration for Conscious Living. And very excited about today's show. We're going to have a great conversation here tonight. My guest is a writer, thinker, engineer, and nomad. He explores human nature, our growing planetary societal responsibility, and our place in the cosmos. In early 2010, he sold nearly all of his possessions and left a decade-long career in the IT industry to pursue a childhood dream of traveling the world. He arrived in South India 1 month shy of his 28th birthday with $1,500 to his name and one bag on his back. Instead of discovering himself, he discovered an entire planet that needed his help. Joining me via Skype from Ithaca, New York, it's Ram Dev. Ram, welcome to Radio Enzo.
Thank you, Greg. Great to be here.
Cool. And Ram was able to find some good Wi-Fi for us tonight here, hook up on Skype. We've got a nice clean connection tonight, and excited about that. And excited because I was introduced to Ram's work recently by another Radio Enzo guest, Niall Daugherty. And when I was talking to Niall after our recent conversation, I was saying, who are some people, Niall, that you've met and discovered in the past year or two that really have made an impact on you and are really your people that are doing the sorts of things that you want to be talking about and writing about and looking at? And he said, you have to check out Ram's work. He's really doing some great things out there, and he's really initializing some conversations and trying to get people to think and talk about the things that really matter on this planet. So that's hopefully we'll do as much of that as we can here in the next hour. So, Ram, first of all, what are you doing in Ithaca, New York? I know you are a digital nomad traveling the world. what's the stop in Ithaca all about?
I'm actually on a small USA road trip right now, and someone that I've known online for a little while invited me to come meet them in Ithaca, New York, and it was sort of on my way to where I was going, and. And yeah, so I stopped here, and I've been hanging out here for the whole afternoon. I'm probably going to stay here for the night. And yeah, so Molly, her name is Molly Yarrington. She's just one of the readers that's been reading my blog for a while, and I've exchanged a bunch of emails with her back and forth. Awesome person. And yeah, so she invited me out on this road trip, and that's where I am now. And I had almost forgotten about the radio thing because we were talking so much. And at the last minute, I was like, I need a place with good Wi-Fi, and she offered a place to stay. So, yeah, that's where I am now. It's really just I move by whatever the universe tells me to do. And I didn't think the universe would be having me stay in Ithaca, New York tonight. But at the last minute, I realized, wait, I've got an interview to do tonight. I can't go anywhere. So that's where I am.
Well, very happy that you remember. That's that's good. So.
I had like four reminders set up in my calendar, but somehow I guess I missed them.
Well, cool.
But yeah.
Well, we're going to talk tonight about we're going to go kind of big picture and small picture, and we're going to talk about Ram's journey from his current lifestyle and what he's doing and what he's writing about to how he got to that point, growing up and how that developed. We're going to talk about something called income ethics. What does that mean? What's that all about? We're going to talk about responsibility as a planet, as a society, as a people. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Ram's embrace of practical minimalism. It's something that he practices and talks to other folks about. And sustainable abundance. How much is enough? How much is too much? What are we shooting for? What are we working towards here? So Ram, if you could, in a very short synopsis, tell people sort of what you're up to these days. What are you doing?
I would say that I'm up to living. I intentionally do not try to plan out things too much or try to have a set schedule or a specific goal. I would say more than anything right now, I'm exploring, and I do a lot of stuff by instinct. I just follow whatever my intuition tells me to do. But right now I decided that within the past few days, actually, I just spontaneously decided to start this road trip. And I'm going over to meet a friend in Auburn, Indiana, who I've known for 10 years online. And then from there down to Florida, where I'll probably stay for a few months.
Cool. And while you're traveling around, you make your living as a writer and an online creator, correct?
Correct. I do a lot of writing, but I also have a background in IT and in the IT industry. So I do a lot of web development, a lot of freelance work. I recently got hired to do some support for a WordPress plugin, a premium WordPress plugin. So now I'm doing that and toning down my freelance stuff a little bit so that I have enough free time for creating. But it's a whole mixture of things.
Cool. So as you're traveling around, you wrote in one of your recent pieces, you said, in the past year, I've traveled across the planet, I've sailed on the Pacific Ocean, piloted a small airplane, watched the space shuttle launch, and I've trekked up into the Himalayan mountains. And I've done all of that and gained a lifetime of experiences on less than $15,000 U.S. dollars. This is my enough. If there are people, billions of people on this planet who can survive on $4 a day, then you say you can certainly find a way to thrive on $40 a day. And I think that's a tremendous perspective, because I think that people assume, a good chunk of Americans at least assume, that having those sorts of experiences and living that sort of life is beyond them and beyond what they're capable of and would cost enormous sums of money. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I think what it's funny you mentioned the flying in the airplane thing, because the same chance in a million opportunity that I felt gave me the opportunity to fly in an airplane or to fly an airplane occurred again to without any planning, without any foresight of it yesterday. So I flew an airplane yesterday with the same person that I flew almost a year ago because he lives in Saratoga Springs, New York, and that was on my way, well, partially on my way on this road trip. And him, the pilot, Joel Glickman, and Felice Banner, they gave me a place to stay for the night. But I actually arrived in Saratoga Springs, and they sent me a message and said, "Hey, you know, we're landing at the airport. If you wanna go up and fly, just meet us at the airport, and we can make that happen." And the timing worked. But for me, when I thought more about like, how is that possible? Like, how am I lucky enough to do that? And it cost me nothing. I mean, I paid gas is essentially what it cost me to get there, which I was going there anyway. And I realized that the reason, the number one thing that led me to that was the combination of simply being friendly and helpful and being open to new experiences and just being,
right.
You know, being someone that is genuine and just authentic and not always looking for something for yourself. And I would say that, I mean, as simple as that sounds, that to me is what I can lead back all of the incredibly fortunate things that have happened to me over the past, well, my whole life, really, but over the past 2 years in particular, lead back to that.
Right. Now, Ram, were those characteristics that you felt you were born with, that your parents instilled into you, or were those characteristics that you had to learn work towards later in life?
I think they were definitely there with me all the time, but I feel like perhaps they were masked over or painted over by a lot of internal resistance, a lot of personal fears, a lot of societal things, a lot of expectations external to me that, you know, made me feel like, well, you shouldn't be too nice because then people could take advantage of you, or
right.
you shouldn't go and do this because it might be a little bit too risky. So I feel like in the past 2 years, I've been uncovering a lot of that and sort of on this personal journey that I certainly feel I've barely scratched the surface of just unraveling that and uncovering that part of my life, I guess, that I feel it was always there. It's just, it wasn't always accessible or I wasn't always tapping into it.
Right. So sort of like an onion almost, you're sort of peeling back the layers one by one.
Exactly. But I think that, I mean, my gut says that we're all born relatively pure, but we're all born pure in that sense of that we're genuinely wanting to help people. Like you look at a child, you don't see children like 2 years old. My nephew is about 2.5 now, and I've just been amazed at how he can have a toy that he absolutely loves. And as he gets older, I'm noticing this change, but he can have a toy that he absolutely loves. He's so excited about. And what's the first thing he does? He lifts up that toy and he wants to share it with you. He wants
right.
to share in the experience of the joy that he's experiencing, because that's a natural human instinct to share in what brings us life, essentially.
Right. So how do young children at some point go from that wanting to share to me, mine, you know, right. must have. Don't give it away. You know, so how does that happen? Do you know? Is it a cultural thing, a psychological thing in our development?
I think it is largely a cultural thing, yes, because I think we're heavily influenced, especially a child's development is heavily influenced by its by the culture that child's brought up in. But I also think that there's also that that transition to feeling a sense of identity. You know, I've been noticing watching my nephew grow up, and I've been watching my nephew grow up because I'm not there all the time. I'm traveling, so I see him, you know, in 6 month segments. So every time I come back and I see him, to me the changes that to my sister and my mom, my family, and everyone else who sees him on a daily basis, they're not as obvious to them as they are to me because I see these very clear differences. And I just noticed that as he gains a sense of identity, he gains a sense of he gains a sense of ego. He understands that I am this person sitting here. I am Lincoln. I'm, you know, I have a specific name. Right. Then he starts to feel this more this attachment to things that he thinks as his. But I think that's just I don't think that's unnatural. I think that's natural. I just think that we as adults could do more to guide that
right.
versus just saying, well, we'll let nature take its course and whatever happens, happens. Well, what's going to happen is people are going to be more likely to be egotistical and more likely to be attached to things or feel like they like something belongs to them or they have a right to do something, like they're entitled to something.
Right. The sense of separation gets greater.
Right.
Indeed. So, well, Ram, you practice a philosophy of practical minimalism. What is that? What is a minimalist?
Well, I'd say that when I first started getting into the minimalist thing, I guess you could say, I mean, I definitely was not a minimalist all my life. I was, I mean, I've always been a techie. I've always been a geek. So my tables, wherever I went, were just covered in all kinds of stuff. I always kept things. I was, you know, somewhat of a pack rat. I always could foresee a use for some tool or something that I had and not want to throw it away.
Right. Like old computer parts and
right.
stuff that from 15 years ago you might need.
I had a closet full of computer parts that were like, it was just tons and tons. And I had like probably 15 old computers. Like I never wanted to throw away an old computer because there was always some random part that I just might need someday.
right.
That, you know, I just realized after a while, well, what happened was enough time went by and a couple of different events happened in my life that taught me how freeing the release of things felt and how much freedom I did not have that I suddenly had. And I did not realize I didn't have it when I didn't have it. Yeah. But as soon as that freedom arrived, it was you know, it was almost addictive to get rid of stuff that I didn't actually need.
Were those events, did you bring those events on or were those forced on you by the outside?
Well, I had invested in a couple of real estate properties in my early 20s and doing it as a long-term investment kind of thing and had bought tools to fix up the property because I did all the maintenance, I did all the repairs, I did all that stuff. And then I ended up losing the properties in 2007, 2008 because of the financial crisis, the subprime mortgage crisis in 2008,
right.
And ended up filing for bankruptcy to get all that debt out from underneath me. And as part of getting rid of the houses, I ended up having to sell like my tools and different things like that. And I started to realize as I started to let these things go, and the houses included, even though that really wasn't voluntary, that I just started to feel this freedom of, you know, of going from three houses is how many houses I had, 12 rental units altogether, down to zero houses and, you know, just emptying more and more stuff and selling things and not really having anywhere to store all this extra stuff that I had anyway, because I had it stored in the basements of the houses.
Yeah.
So once I started to do that, I started to realize, wow, I actually feel so much better not having all this stuff. And I, at that point, I was down to like an apartment with probably a dozen, maybe a dozen and a half boxes of stuff. And I started getting rid of things just little by little. And the more I got rid of, the more I realized how little I needed. And for me, it was whenever I thought about, well, should I get rid of it or should I keep it? And the question or the thing that I used as a guidepost to that was, well, what's my goal? Where do I want to go? What's my direction? And I realized that I've always wanted to travel. I've always wanted to, you know, see the world and be able to explore and things like that. And I hadn't realized, well, all this stuff that I have is really preventing that from happening. And I think I was sitting in a cafe somewhere, and I looked at my backpack sitting in the table across from me, and I realized on a day-to-day basis, I bring that bag with me everywhere I go, and that's all I really need. Everything I need to live, to move around, my laptop, maybe a few clothes, you know, a few little basic things fit in that bag,
yeah.
And that's all I need. And that became my target. My target became, if I want to travel the world, I want to do so with one bag on my back. And that means that everything else in my life that does not fit in that one bag needs to go, because it's not practical for the direction I'm going. And that's how the whole idea of practical minimalism came about, because I find that a lot of people that I've talked to use minimalism as to an extreme. So I think that some people misunderstand other people's interpretation of minimalism, and they feel like, well, it means to just get rid of everything and to sell stuff, or even worse, to throw stuff in the trash that doesn't need to be thrown, stuff that can be reused or sold or
right.
given away. So for me, that's impractical. Practical would be, well, if you have a family, if you plan to live in a house, then you keep a house. And if you plan to live in a house, you probably need silverware and you need dishes. Dishes and silverware is impractical for me, because I move around so much that it doesn't make sense to carry them with me.
Yeah.
So practical minimalism for a family of four living in a house would be much different than practical minimalism for me traveling the world with a bag on my back.
Right. And you mentioned in writing about this, you say that it means not holding on to things out of fear of losing them, the sort of scarcity
right.
mindset, instead of recognizing that you increase your strength by letting them go, the abundance mindset. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. Like I was saying with the dishes, you know, if I had a set of dishes that I carried everywhere with me, they would be because maybe they're my favorite dishes and I don't want to lose them, or because someone gave them to me as a gift and they're super precious and they're super important to me.
Right.
So
some relative told you that, oh, they have an importance to them, so can
yes.
you hold on to them for us?
Exactly. So if I did that, if I held on to them out of fear that, well, maybe it was a fear of making my relatives feel bad because they gave them to me and I don't want to just give them away or sell them or make them disappear.
Or someday they'll be worth money.
Right, or somebody, anything like that. If it's a car, like I had when I was investing in the properties, I had a two cars, which was ridiculous in retrospect. But I bought the second car because it was an Audi TT. It's a really like futuristic looking car, and I remember buying it because it was relatively cheap. It was like $14,000, which that car is usually like $28,000. And I thought, and I had read something around the same time, like, hey, you can buy, you know, fancy, if you buy the right fancy car today, then in 50, 60 years, that car will be worth so much money because it'll be, you know, like an antique. And I actually bought this car and kept it for 2 years with that thought in mind, like, oh, I'll struggle left and right to afford this car because someday far in the future, it'll be worth a whole lot of money. Using the car as an example, it would not be worth a lot of money because it would have taken so much of my life away to keep it there until the 70 years was up.
Right.
And going back to the dishes example, the dishes, if I took them with me, would actually decrease in value and importance to me because they become a nuisance. They become a burden to me.
Yeah,
and
they're
no longer
weight.
Useful. Yeah, a weight, exactly.
And like, or an anchor even.
And if I let those dishes go and I say, why do I need dishes? I need dishes to eat. So suddenly I say, I'm a world traveler. Wherever I go, there's probably going to be dishes. And when you actually think about that, really think about it, and you realize that, wow, I have all the dishes in the world. That's how many dishes I have. Like, you start switching your mindset to one set of dishes, from that to, I have all the dishes that exist in the world. They're mine. Because whenever I need dishes, wherever I go, I'm going to have them.
Right.
And to actually like feel that, and to feel that about everything, to feel that about people, about places, about things.
Right. Not just stuff, but it could be knowledge, it could
absolutely.
Be experience, it could be anything.
Absolutely. And that's, with knowledge is a good example, because I'm someone who is extremely hungry for knowledge, and my entire life I've always been, I've always had the thought in mind that I want to learn everything. Like, I've never let go of that. For a long time, I never let go of that. I always wanted to learn everything. And the internet makes it extremely clear that that's impossible.
Yeah, you could spend until the end of time attempting
exactly,
to learn everything.
Exactly, and releasing that. Like, it took me a little while to actually let go of that, to say, it's okay to not know everything. Because in doing that, you actually will you know, start to learn stuff. Like, you'll actually start to know stuff, and that will fill any sense of scarcity. Like, the scarcity mindset comes down to feeling like you have to know everything. There has to be, like, a set amount of stuff, and you have to grab onto it. And if you can't grab onto that, then it just becomes this huge burden. It becomes this huge roadblock. You can't proceed forward. You can't actually learn anything because you're so obsessed with learning everything. And as soon as you release that, then suddenly everything becomes available to you. And suddenly anything you want to learn, you can learn.
Right. So these concepts and these things that came to you over time, these were gradual realizations for you over time.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about your background. You grew up near Boston, Massachusetts. Is that correct?
Correct. A little bit north. In it was actually in New Hampshire, but it's like 30 miles north of Boston, Massachusetts.
Cool. And you mentioned in your bio that you said your parents adopted a combination of Buddhist and Hindu teachings before you were born, I guess, and that your childhood was very much oriented towards that culture, correct?
Yeah, exactly that. My parents, they were not born into any of this stuff, but they were both drawn towards it before they got married. And then when they got married, they just decided that this is what they were going to do. They follow a guru, and they decided to adopt that their family, meaning me, my brother, and my sister, we were going to have a certain lifestyle, and this is what they were going to do. And they decided to raise us with no television in the house, no furniture in the house. We ate on the floor like Indian style. We slept on the floor. You know, we were a strict vegetarian. You know, we ate dairy, milk, and cheese, but no poultry, no fish, no eggs. And right. You know, we did a lot of Indian custom, a lot of Indian things that were very customary to Indians, like, or maybe not Indians. I shouldn't say that because that is a little bit misleading. It's not really customary to Indians, a lot of the stuff we did, because they followed a lot of ancient Hindu teachings,
right.
A lot of Vedic teachings. And, you know, we did things like, our birthdays, we had fire ceremonies instead of birthday cakes.
I think I missed out. I think I would have liked a fire ceremony as a kid. So when you were a younger child at this age, did you have any sense of, well, my childhood in the United States is vastly different from the majority of children growing up around me, or were you sort of in a community of people where you really didn't know any different?
No, I was definitely aware that it was different and that there were not, you know, that it wasn't the norm.
Right.
I was also homeschooled, so I did not have a ton of social exposure. But I was aware because my grandparents happened to live on the same street that my parents did. My aunts and uncles lived on the same street that my parents did. So they remained, you know, they continued following whatever culture they were raised in. And my family was polar opposite of that almost. So for me, just even having my grandparents come over to the house, it was very obvious that from the earliest age that we were doing something different, you know. And my parents explained that too. They explained that this isn't the norm, that this is, you know, they contrasted things for me as we were growing up. So I was definitely very aware of it.
Right. Did you have any sense of I'm missing out on these other things, or was there a sense of, wow, this is really cool, I'm very fortunate to have these experiences as a kid? Or was that sort of a mixed bag?
I don't think it was either, actually. I think it was I don't think I thought either way. Like, I didn't feel like I was missing out. I didn't feel like I was doing something cool. It was just, that's the way it was.
Right.
And to this day, I mean, I'm much less into that stuff, if you will, than my dad still is, for example. I mean, he still reads about that stuff. He still meditates, still does a lot of the mantras and things like that. Still does some fire ceremonies at other people's houses sometimes. But I'm disconnected from that. I'm more interested in the deeper philosophical stuff, in the actual, like, how I live my life and how other people live their lives kind of thing. So, I mean, I can see myself going back into the direction my dad is now as I get older, sure, but
right.
Definitely not so interested in that as he is.
Right, and so this interest in knowledge and in you teaching yourself and really allowing yourself to learn and wanting to learn, I'm guessing that was instilled by your parents as well?
Absolutely. My dad always, if I said there's one thing my dad taught me that I feel was invaluable to my life till today, is the idea of never accepting any answer as the answer. So he would tell me all kinds of things. He would tell me why we're not eating meat, or he'd tell me why we don't do this or why we don't do that. And, you know, he would have the ground rules. Like, as I got older into my early teens, and he was like, if you're living in this house, you don't eat meat. If you're living in this house, you don't drink alcohol. If you're living in this house, you don't smoke. If you don't, you know, he had all these things. And he was like, this is the rules of this house. But when you turn 18, you can leave and you can go drink. You can go smoke. You can go eat meat. You can go do whatever you want to do, because that's your journey. All I can do as a father is give you what I believe is the best path, but I can't take the path for you. You have to take it. So he was very, very clear on that, to, you know, take whatever he teaches me and go and question it. Go ask. I mean, obviously he didn't want me to go drink. That wasn't what he was saying, or want me to go eat meat. But he was saying that he can't stop me from doing that.
Yeah, it was your choice.
My choice, exactly. And that never accepting an answer. For example, from a very early age, I asked him, you know, what's the point of life? Like, what's the point of existence? Like, I didn't get it. And
nice. A small question.
I think it was after my grandfather on my dad's side passed away. I must have been six or seven or eight, somewhere around there. And I first understood the concept of death. And I clearly remember asking my dad, if everybody dies, then why are we living? Like, what's the point? And this is a question he pondered himself, obviously, as well. And he gave me an answer, and it didn't satisfy me. And for my entire childhood, I can recall asking him over and over and over again at different points, what's the point of it all? What's the meaning of it? And each time he would either give me a slightly different answer, or a slightly more enhanced answer, or a deeper answer, or whatever, but I was still never satisfied. And anytime I felt frustrated about that, he always reminded me, that's okay. It's good not to be satisfied and to have an answer and to just go with it, because asking it and discovering it for yourself is what's important.
Right. And so are you still asking that question yourself?
Absolutely. I mean, I would say that I'm when I was younger, I was a little more obsessed, I guess, with trying to figure it out. I've sort of come to a compromise internally that the meaning of life could very well be to live life. And if that is the case, then constantly questioning what the meaning of life is actually taking me away from what I'm supposed to be doing.
Stop the questions, go live.
Go live, exactly. So I still take plenty of time to think about things like this, and it's still always in the back of my mind, but I would say that I wouldn't say that's my search. I wouldn't say that's my ultimate quest right now, to figure out what the point of life is. I feel my purpose is much more exploration related, much more to live in the best way that I feel I can live, and to continue exploring and learning and things like that.
Yeah, and you wrote about a similar theme on your blog recently. You wrote, "You are not what you read," was the title of the piece. It was an essay, and you mentioned that, you know, stop spending all your time on social media or reading about what other people have done to change the world. And, you know, all these, you know, it's great. I hope people listen to the show. I hope they're listening to my show, and I hope they're reading your blog, but that shouldn't be the sum total of their experience. That should be part of what they do. And then, you know, do more than read and listen, get out there and do those things. And I thought it was a really cool piece. It was just sort of a imploration to, get off and do it.
Yeah, I would say that piece actually was born, as most of my pieces are, from a reflection of how I was spending time reading a lot of things. And I don't think there's anything wrong with reading. I mean, some people misunderstood that piece as, you know, that, well, we should read because if we enjoy it or whatever. I definitely think that knowledge distribution and knowledge transfer is extremely important. And I think that things like your show, which, you know, connect people and tell stories and things like that, encourage and provide the tools and provide the inspiration necessary to do stuff. I just feel that perhaps we human beings have an inclination to take the back seat and watch the driving happening instead of actually doing the driving and feeling what it's like to be behind the wheel and feel the bump in the car and feel what it's like when you press the gas pedal and you actually feel the engine roaring. I mean, you don't get any of that when you're sitting in the back seat. And it's very easy to sit in the back seat and to enjoy the ride and to look out the window and not really, you know, not really experience life. And I catch myself in the back seat all the time. And it's a constant reminder to me, because you know, if we're not actually living life, if we're not actually taking these things that are inspiring us and doing something useful with them, doing something life-changing with them, actually applying them to our life, if we're just talking about them or thinking about them or reading them or whatever, or dreaming about them,
right,
then, or for that matter, writing about them, if we're just writing about the things we want to do, then they have no tangible value to the world, because, you know, like Mahatma Gandhi said, you have to be the change that you want to see in the world. And that is simply because there's no better instigator for change, no better inspiration than to see someone else doing the very thing that either they say they're going to do or doing the very thing that you feel you should be doing. To see someone else doing it, it's, you know, incredibly empowering.
Right, and doing it repetitively, not just doing it once. It doesn't count. You do it once, and okay, you're done now. You've helped the world. Great, you're good.
Right, it's changing your whole. I like to call it your whole lifestyle, because, and I feel like lifestyle is a much bigger word than it's given credit for, because there's just so many things that apply to your lifestyle, from the way you think, from the way you approach life, the things you own, to where you lived, all these things. I think they're all part of your lifestyle. And actually changing your lifestyle and shaping it, and shaping it in such a way that you feel is in line with what feels true to you, like what actually feels true to your heart. Like you feel, you know, I'm living the way I'm supposed to be living, the way I feel I'm supposed to be living. That is important. You know, it's important to feel like you're actually doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Right.
And I used to think for a long time before I went to India and before I quit my job and did all this crazy stuff, that you know, all of that stuff was just talk. That I read plenty of things that said, well, you know, when you're actually doing what you're supposed to be doing, you won't be able to sleep at night because you'll be just so interested in doing it and working and doing all these things. And I didn't really believe it until it actually happened. And I realized how real that was, and that, you know, when you are actually living fully in line with what you feel you should be doing or what you feel you're supposed to be doing, you just feel like you're on the top of the world. And I think that passion, that living with passion, inspires others, even if you don't communicate with them, even if you don't talk to them, just living and being yourself and living that life, no matter what it is.
In a peak experience or a flow state, sort of, where you're really right, connecting with those things.
And I think a lot of people have experienced like the flow state for short intervals of time. I mean, I certainly have throughout my whole life. I feel like the more I focus on what I have to do to get myself more in line with a continual state of flow, a continual state of always feeling like I'm choosing the right thing, meaning what feels right to me, the more I aspire towards that, the more my life feels to be a continuous state of flow. I mean, there's plenty of bumps along the way, as I think is inevitable.
Right.
But I definitely feel like that's something worthy of aspiring towards, instead of just assuming like, oh, you can only tap into that once in a while. No, I think you can do things to align your life with in such a way that your day-to-day life feels like a moving meditation. You know, you go through life always feeling like this is where you're supposed to be, this is what you're supposed to be doing, and you're living true to yourself, and you're open-minded to new ways of living and new knowledge and new experiences.
Yeah. So let's talk about the crazy stuff, as you called it a while ago. In 2010, you sold most of your stuff and you went to India. Talk to me about that. Was that something that had been in the works that you thought about, planned for many years? Tell me about how that came to be, and then what happened when you did that.
Well, I suppose you could say I was planning it, in that my whole life I've always felt that I was going to do this someday. I didn't know when, I didn't know where, I didn't know how.
Do this in a more sort of nebulous sense versus a concrete, I'm going to go to India and do this specific thing?
Right. Like, since I was a teenager, 13, 14 years old, I can remember feeling like in my 20s, in my late 20s, at some point in around that time, I'm going to travel the world. Like, even when I was 13, I was dreaming of traveling the world. Of course, at that age, it just wasn't practical. But I always felt like this is what I was going to do, this is what I wanted to do. So in that sense, it was planned that way. But
right,
as far as the idea of actually, I mean, and then I grew up from 13 years old, and I got a job, and I invested in properties, and I did all this other stuff, you know, tied me down very much and made that dream not very reachable. But then the universe worked in such a way that, you know, the subprime mortgage crisis happened, and things turned out. I mean, I had no intention of losing the properties. I bought those properties with the intention of keeping them for 30 years. And then actually I sort of my intention was to keep them for 30 years. And then, hey, when I'm 40 or 50 years old, I'll have all this money that I can go travel the world with. But things turned out where the subprime mortgage crisis happened and I lost all three properties and I was suddenly down to practically nothing. I had no stuff. I was enjoying getting rid of stuff. And I was working at the time at a startup in Cambridge, and I had an office with a nice view of Boston. And I just remember, it was a nice office. I won't deny that. I had an incredible view. I was incredibly fortunate to be where I was. I mean, I was working with, you know, MIT grads, and I was a homeschooler that, you know, never had any college education. So it was an incredible opportunity. It was perfect for where I was. But I was looking out the window one day, and I always had this thing in the back of my mind. Like, I was always putting this dream of travel, of doing all this crazy stuff. I was always putting it off till tomorrow. And I was always doing that because what I had now and what seemed to be right around the corner made more sense. It was more practical. It was the right thing to do, you know? And I had family, I had friends, I had society, I had everybody else to remind me that you should do what makes the most sense. I mean, especially if you have a good job.
Right. It's a good sensible.
Sensible thing to do, exactly. And I had pushed things off, if you will, over and over and over for my whole life until that point. And I remember just looking out the window, and there was a bird that flew by, like a pigeon or something, and it flew by and it went like towards the horizon, towards the Boston skyline. And I've always been jealous of birds because of their freedom. Like I was driving on the highway one time, stuck in traffic, 2-hour drive home, bumper to bumper traffic, getting off the off ramp very slowly in traffic. Look over, there's a big patch of grass, a bunch of Canadian geese sitting there, and I felt genuinely jealous for the geese. And it was at that point where I was like, I'm a human being, and I feel jealous of an animal. And that just makes no sense.
Right.
And I analyzed that for a little while during the drive, and I realized it's because they have the freedom to go where they want to go, to get up and fly and do whatever they want to do. And they're living in harmony with what feels true to them. When they're hungry, they go eat. When they, you know, when they feel like they should fly over here, they do that. So I had a lot of recurring experiences like that during this whole period of like my late teens and most of my 20s. And it all came to this point where I was sitting in the office, looking out the window, bird flies by, and I felt something inside starting to say, you know, well, maybe this is it. Maybe you're not going to do anything else. You know, maybe you really are just going to continue living the way you are now. And those dreams will forever be something you look back on and say, well, I could have done that, but I didn't.
Wow, that had to be very suffocating.
It was almost like there was this other thing inside of me, something that had more control over me, that was like ready to die, you know, that was like ready to give up, was ready to say, well, you've held on for 15 years or whatever it's been since your early teens when you've been dreaming of doing this. And now after all these years of all these houses and all these jobs and all these things, you finally get to the conclusion that, well, it's probably never going to happen. And that acceptance, which had never happened up until that point, is what, you know, scared me. It scared me enough to say, well, throwing away my job, throwing away all my stuff and all this stuff, that is far less risky than letting this dream die, if you will, letting this feeling of well, you know, I may never do anything with my life that I really want to do, that I feel I should be doing. I may just go through life, you know, like a robot doing right. whatever you know, I think I'm supposed to be doing. So I have a few hours after that, after thinking long and hard about that, I wrote an email to my boss that very night and told him I got to talk about my employment the next day. And I told him that, you know, I'm quitting my job in 3 months, go and travel the world. And that was it. And I had no planning. I had no idea where I was going to go in the world. I just told him straightforward, exactly like I just told you. That was the extent of my plans.
And then you're like, okay, now what? Now what do I do? Where do I go? So why India? Is it because of the background from your parents and the things that you learned about as a child?
Not so much. I mean, I over the next few months, I literally told everyone that I was going somewhere in the world, didn't know where. And then people would say, well, I have a friend over here, a friend over there. You know, you can go stay with them. So I had all kinds of options available to me in terms of people had invited me to come stay here and there as I started to tell people this, that I was doing this. And one of the people that heard about what I was doing, that I was going to go somewhere, was a good friend of my family, and he lives in Bangalore, India, and he has a solar company over there, Selco Solar, and it's a world-renowned solar company. He does a lot of humanitarian work over there, but he heard about it, and he's like, hey, why don't you come to Bangalore? You know, I'll give you a place to stay for the first week. You can stay at my mom's house, and from there you can go on, and you can, you know, go explore and do whatever you want to do. And to me, from a practical standpoint, which not having a plan, I'm very much a planner, and I've worked really hard to get that out of my system. For me, it made a lot of practical sense that, okay, now I know someone in this foreign country. So at least for week one, I have this adjustment period where there's someone I know and I'm staying with someone. And from there, I can get my feet wet and go out. And the other thing was that, yes, I actually went to India when I was 3 years old with my parents. I have a few memories of that.
Yeah.
And I thought it kind of ironic that, you know, 25 years later, I would go back to India as someone much different than the 3-year-old, but perhaps not so much different in that I was trying to reset everything. I was trying to go back to square one and say, start exploring as if none of this other stuff is in your life as you're getting rid of it all, and start fresh. Start discovering what you want to do, who you are, you know, to discover the world for that matter. Remain very open-minded. So that's what I did. I started out extremely open-minded, not the plan. I mean, I had a rough plan starting South India, go to North India, and go all. I was going to go all the way around to North India because my 6-month flight came back from Bangalore, the same place I started. So I really had no plans. I mean, it was really just as I go.
Right. So, Ram, what did you see and experience in India that changed you? Because you write about that. You write about the different. I mean, there was clearly a shift. You clearly saw and experienced things there that were really changed the focus of where you were going forward.
Yeah, there was a lot of interesting experiences that happened during my first 3 months in India. I was in India for 3 months initially, and then I went to Vietnam, and then to Nepal, and then back to India. But I was in India for 3 months, and during the first 3 months, everything from when I first landed there, the person that I was staying with, I told you, he does a lot of humanitarian work, so I was at his office for the first week, and I went and I worked on my laptop from their office. And I was working alongside other interns who were doing humanitarian work. I mean, that's what they were spending their day doing. And here I was, you know, getting on Twitter and getting on and Facebook and writing on my blog and really just talking about how cool it was to be in India. And I didn't. And so for me, it was like this clear distinction between people doing something purposeful in the world, very valuable with their time, and here's me not doing so much. And I did a lot to not let that bother me because I also recognize that I'm doing this because I feel that this is what I'm supposed to be doing. But I'd say that's what planted the seed for the train of thought that I took with me as I started traveling through India. And that was to remain open-minded to what I'm doing in my life in relation to what the world needs or to what the state of the world is, if you will. And just seeing the poverty, seeing the contrast of slums 10 feet away from big glass skyscrapers in Bangalore, multi-million-dollar skyscrapers, and just that making no sense in my head that there could be a multi-million-dollar skyscraper with people living in absolute poverty just feet away.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make sense. From a human standpoint, it doesn't make sense. I don't care what it means economically. I don't care what it means culturally. From a human standpoint, it does not make sense.
Yeah, if somebody landed in a spaceship from another planet and saw that, they'd be scratching their, you know, heads or whatever they had, you know, sort of, what? Why?
That they actually would not land in the first place.
They'd be revulsed, you know, and leave, turn around and leave.
They don't have anything to do with these people.
Right.
But yeah, I kept that open mind over the course of the next 3 months, my idea of what I was doing in India slowly transitioned. Like I felt I came to India looking for myself, you know, trying to search for what I was supposed to do, what I wanted to do with life for that matter. You know, I felt it was very inward focused. And I don't know if it's just a result of me naturally being open to new things, but there was something about the trip that changed that from an inward focus to being very, I don't know what the word is, maybe like empathetic towards, or very, very aware of what's going on in the rest of the world, to be frank. I mean, there's 500 million people in India alone that are under the poverty line, and that's
right.
More people than all of the United States has. So,
right. Well, lots of people are aware of that fact, but how many people actually have the sensation or the feeling that they can do anything about it?
I think that for me, and that feeling of not being able to do anything about it grew from that point on, because as I started to investigate, what can I do? And I started to see, what are other people doing? And, you know, I see organization after organization after organization dedicated to doing these things, and how, I mean, I'm sure many of them are having a lot of impact, but the problem isn't solved. You know, there's still problems.
Right.
And for me, it was like, you know, I started to learn more and more how monolithic the problem is, but also how monolithic the solution is attempting to be. And that led me back to, well, what can I do? I don't have millions of dollars. I'm not a very social person, so I don't have tons of connections with people in high places and all that stuff. I don't have friends in big circles. What can I do? You know, what can Ram Dev do that will be positive for the world, will be positive for these people? I mean, no matter how indirect, what can I do?
Right.
And as I investigated that, I started to discover more and more, and I started to realize how my actions, whether it's down to the way I live, whether it's down to how much I, take control, or not take control, but like accept the responsibility of doing something purposeful with my life and following what I feel I should be doing. How much I do that, I mean, that alone inspires the rest of the world, inspires all the people around me. And that, again, it reverberates, you know, all the way through time. And it does affect those poor people that I see in some indirect way. I mean, maybe not today, but maybe it affects their children or their grandchildren. And I think at the very base, all of us are capable of doing that. That's not something we need any amount of money for. And that to me was extremely empowering, to realize that any one of us, with no matter how little money we have the ability to change the world.
Yeah.
I mean, just like you said, be the change you wish to see in the world. That's what, you know, I feel like that's what he was saying. You know, you have to actually live that change that you feel should be changed, and the world will gravitate towards it.
Right. And you have an awesome series that takes all of these concepts much further. I highly recommend it. And we're not going to have time to go nearly in depth as much as I'd like to in this topic, but it's about the topic of income equity. And you mentioned in part two of this series, it's a four-part series on ramdev.com. You mentioned if you can afford three meals a day, you're in the top 15% of the wealthiest humans on Earth. Which is a really staggering fact that I don't think many people here in the United States realize even. You know, you understand that there's poverty in the world, but when you really – you have an actual graph on the piece that shows that charts, you know, from the ultra-poor to the people that are, you know, lower poverty to medium poverty and up through, you know, the top 15%. And that's a really staggering fact. And you say, I thought this was really the key, you say, throughout history, the wealthy members of successful societies acted as the caretakers and custodians of their community. They used their wealth to ensure a moral, just, and dignified standard of living. The societies that failed, they all had one thing in common. The wealthy hoarded. And then you go on to talk about social responsibility. And it seems like that social responsibility, the theme of that is really a good chunk of what you're writing about and talking about these days. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'd say it's always evolving. The name of the series was Income Ethics, not Income Equity.
I knew I would blow that. I predicted pre-show that I would incorrectly say that. Income Ethics, indeed.
Yeah. Yeah, social responsibility, but I feel I almost feel the danger in calling it social responsibility is that it almost puts the problem outside of yourself, because you think social, you don't think you. You think social, you think the people outside of you. And I feel it becomes a social responsibility when we as a community, or we as a collection of people choosing to make the right choices, choosing to be responsible, that collectively becomes our social responsibility. Like that, what we do individually, collectively, those individual actions, that is our social responsibility. And what we choose to do with it, whether we choose to just neglect it, whether we choose to say, well, you know, people are starving over there and I don't care. I'm going to own three houses that are, you know, two of them are my vacation homes, and I'm just going to let them sit there for most of the year. And the rest of the year, I'm going to live in this house. I mean, to me, socially, from a global perspective, that doesn't make sense. I mean, or when it comes to food or anything else like that.
It's essentially personal responsibility that translates through action to a societal level, essentially.
Absolutely, exactly.
Cool.
My message, if anything, is that individually our actions have an impact, and that those actions automatically, whether those actions are combining with are in your family or in your town or in your country or on the planet, no matter where they are, those actions are combined. And combined, they have a huge effect on the evolution of the world, if you will, and the evolution of time. And that's why no matter how little you feel you're doing, if you're doing it, you know, to your fullest extent and fully leading with your heart forward, that those changes are going to be far, much further reaching than any of us can imagine. Like, we can't fathom how far reaching they are.
Right. Right. So what is income ethics? What does that mean? Talk to me about what that is, so that concept.
Income ethics is actually something I've been thinking about a lot since my trip to India and while I was in India, because, again, this is part of, I had quit my job. I was going to try to rewrite what I was doing with my life. And obviously part of living in today's age requires money. And for me, it took me a long time before I felt ready, if you will, to start charging people for my money, to start asking for money for my writing. And the reason it took me so long is because I felt I wasn't sure, or I didn't understand enough how my asking for money from people affected those poor people in India. Or anywhere else in the world, for that matter. I felt that I personally did not understand how that might work, and I still definitely don't. But I feel like I've worked out a couple of key areas after thinking for a good year that I felt ready enough to move forward. And income ethics for me is really just about being conscious about where your money's coming from, but also where your money is going. And I think that both sides of those equations, both sides of that is very important to income ethics. So if you're working for a big company that is doing all kinds of harm to the environment and to society and to other countries, then that's not ethical. But if you're spending your money on five or six yachts and three or four private airplanes, that's not ethical either. Like this all comes back to what's enough. Like, what do you as a human being need that's enough? And take whatever your attachment to things are and throw them out, whatever your egotistical feeling of, oh, I need these things because they make me feel more powerful, throw all that out and really think, well, as a human being, what's ethical? And because income is such an important part of our society today, and no doubt will continue to be,
right,
I just think important part to focus on, because we all make money and we all spend money. And thinking about the ethics of both sides of that is very important to going in the right direction, to just honestly just be living our life responsibly. That, I think, that's part of the equation. You have to ask those questions.
Right. And you mentioned in part four of the series, a framework for ethical income, where you talk about the ethics that you created. You created a four-part, series, so to speak. You mentioned that you, when you were exploring these things, you were looking at, you know, what other people you were doing. You said that personal ethics were practically non-existent, that there were really no value systems in place for handling income in the society that surrounded you. And the society seemed to encourage a disconnect between the values that you had and your income. So you might claim that I'm supporting this, or I have these personal values, but there was a total disconnect for many people between that and their income, correct?
Yeah, and I think that Yes, and I think that translates the way I interpreted that, because again, there may have been maybe plenty of people who do a lot of good with their money but don't make it apparent. So there's no way for me to learn that about them. My main tool, if you will, for research, for learning all this stuff, was to see, well, what methods would they use to make their income? If it was an unethical means of making the income, then whether they did all the good in the world afterward is not, you know, it somewhat gets tainted. So I think at base, we should be doing things that are, you know, obviously ethical to, like, for example, marketing. I feel like there's so much unethical marketing that goes on, so much, you know, in my opinion, like pop-up ads. Like anyone that I've ever spoken to about pop-up ads, they've told me point blank that they themselves don't feel comfortable using them.
Right.
That they feel they're an annoyance, but they feel that they do a really good job with bringing in subscribers or bringing in money or bringing in whatever.
That's a big debate in the world of bloggers and such.
They just can't get over that feeling. And to me, it's like it should be such a simple decision. If it doesn't feel right to you, you don't do it. I mean, and the only reason you do it is if you're not being ethical about it. If you're like, well, I'm going to be greedy and I'm going to do it. And no, it's just, to me, it's just, and so that is a big part of what I say there seems to be no framework, because there's like, you know, there seems to be so much of, you know, so many things geared around making money at all costs. Like, it doesn't matter what the cost is. If you can make money, then that's what matters.
Right.
And it doesn't matter if you have to lie to people or trick people or be deceiving or for that matter, create stuff. I find this from my own work, and it's one of the reasons I publish so infrequently, because I constantly feel this feeling of, am I just publishing, you know, a repeat of something else that's already out there? Am I just creating noise on the internet? And for me, it's like there's a lot of businesses out there that just, you know, create content that is already out there, but they just create it and they're a little bit better at marketing the keywords, so more they get more traffic and therefore more sales. But it's really just all noise. It's all useless. So for me, I feel that finding our creative spirit, our creative potential, our ability to explore and actually like really take these things seriously, that is extremely important, to create things that are original. Although I'd say that very little stuff is original. I think it's not the originality of it. It's rather the perspective of it and the intent that it's presented with. If we have a good intention and it's presented with that intention, then that stuff has purpose, has use. For example, you know, this show, I mean, I don't know you personally enough to know this, but I would think the reasons for this show's existence is to share in some way. It's to connect. It's to,
indeed,
it's to inspire.
I want to have conversations like this with guests, and I thought it would be cool to talk to people like you that were doing this sort of thing around the world. And so hopefully that other people will enjoy that and maybe take that and into their own lives and maybe incorporate some tools or some inspiration, and that's kind of what it's all about. So, well, I have to cut you off, Ram, because we literally have 2 minutes left in the show. Our hour has flown by. And as I predicted at the beginning of the hour, we did not have time to get a fifth into some of the things that I wanted to get into in our one-hour format here. But I want to talk about, you mentioned a few things real quick at the end of the show. You have an ebook called Small Ways to Make a Big Difference, and it's a collection of pieces by different bloggers and authors and writers and people doing creative projects. That's available on your website?
Yes, it is. If you go to romdev.com/ebooks, you'll find a link to it there. But yeah, it was a collaborative project. It was fantastic. I had like over 40 bloggers contribute to it, and I wrote that while I was in Kathmandu, Nepal. Actually, it was my first ebook.
And very quickly, also, if people want to subscribe, you have actual journal, so people can subscribe to journal entries and notes that aren't on the regular website. Correct?
Correct. I have I don't want to say a private journal, but it definitely goes into much deeper into the stuff that I already write about on the free side. My essays are far more polished. They're far more to specific ideas, whereas my journal is a little more exploratory, a little more share, you know, deeper things and a little bit more, definitely a little more divulging of my own experiences and what my own thoughts are, whereas I strip a lot of that stuff out to get to the point and to be clear in the essays. And
right.
The notes are highlights of other people's work who have inspired me or that I discovered that, you know, made me think about something or contemplate something. So that's my way of sharing other people's work and stuff that really inspires me.
Well, cool. So you can find all that at romdev.com. It's RAAMDEV.com. And Ram, thank you very much for your time tonight. It's been an awesome chat and a great conversation, and really enjoyed having you on the show.
Definitely. It's been awesome. Thank you very much.
No problem. And if anybody's listening in the future episodes, we've got some great guests coming up next week, February 27th. We've got Jacob Sokol of Sensofy. He's going to be here Monday night, 6 p.m. next Monday, the 27th of February. And the first week in March, the first Monday in March, Crystal Street. She's a photographer, documentary filmmaker, and writer. And very much looking forward to those conversations. It's Radio Enzo, Tools and Inspiration for Conscious Living. Please tell your friends and tell anybody that might be interested in these topics. You can pull up the episodes anytime, the archives. You can pull them up to stream to your telephone, to your mobile computing device. They'll stream, they'll download. You can check them out at any time at your convenience. So I'd love to have you listening. And thanks again for joining us tonight. It's Radio Enzo. I'm Greg, and have a great evening.